morning. I'm Tarek, alcoholic addict.
Tarek.
This has been a fun weekend. We greatly appreciate all the attention and the engagement and the questions and all the food and everything. It's been a really good time. We would like to start off this morning with a few moments of silence, and then we'll say the set-aside prayer, and we'll get the morning started. Prayer.
God, please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things that help me see the truth. Amen.
I'm going to read a passage. It's called Cultivation. Imagine a sculpture you work on every day. If you stop, the beauty will slowly go away. What if you were at work on a beautiful sculpture, but your material reverted or decayed if you ever ceased to progress? This is the unfortunate nature of spiritual efforts. You can never stop trying to purify yourself, improve yourself, strengthen yourself, and cultivate the sacred that is inside you. If you do well one day, that is good, but if you cease your efforts, you will slide backwards. That is why you must strive on every level, from the physical to the mental to the spiritual. Your vigilance must never flag. Your determination must never waver. Paradoxically, there is nothing to achieve. It is only our minds that convince ourselves that we must do something. We are already pure, already sacred, but we live in a polluted world. We have egotistical thoughts that constantly divide us from the true spirit, and we cannot remain forever in a pure state and still function in the world. If you attain the higher levels of spirit, you would appear to an outsider as if in a trance, and it would be impossible to interact with others. So if you are trying to be spiritual in today's world, you must never cease striving to keep yourself pure. Once you are not with spirit, you must constantly struggle with the impurity of the world. It's only fitting that that happens to be today's reading.
Mm-hmm.
In this book called 365 Tao. And the first 11 steps that we have covered thus far this weekend are the preparation for the real work in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. And this reading here describes a movement, evolution, and growth for each individual on his spiritual path or her spiritual path. Our determination must never waver. Do we believe our life is on the line? We never stop trying to improve ourselves, to strengthen ourselves, to cultivate that sacred pocket that's within all of us, that's available to us, but it's been covered up by pomp and worship of all kinds of things other than spirit. A At the same time, there's really nothing to do other than wake up. That's really all there is to do. And part of my journey in waking up involves sitting down across the table from other men and taking them through the steps. And I actually wake up in that process. The guy that I'm working with wakes up, and I am responsible, because waking up for an individual is very uncomfortable and can sometimes be very painful. So it's my responsibility to hold his hand while he wakes up. I don't put him through the process. I give him a set of instructions to show him precisely what I did to recover. That's what we do here. We don't try to tell people what to do. We show them what we did. And they have a decision to make. Do you want what I have? Then you do what I do. And in that process, his spirit will wake up. And when it wakes up, I can't just leave him hanging. I've got to help him cultivate that experience. And at the end of the day, we're both cultivating our personal experiences for the same reason. So we can help wake somebody else up. That's true for him. It's true for me. The chapter that we will cover this morning in the first session is called Working with Others. A lot of us, me included, for a while, I'd hear the 12th step, and that's all I thought about was working with others, sponsorship. That's only one part, one out of three for the 12th step. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the first 11 steps, so that's recovery, I carry this message to other addicts and alcoholics who are still suffering, service, and I practice these principles in all my affairs. Unity. All three legacies within the 12th step. So this chapter of working with others, what it describes is it's going to talk about two visits to a new guy. They refer to him as the protege. But before we get to that, I want to point some stuff out. If you guys will turn to the foreword to the first edition, XIV.
No work.
Is that right? Yep. XIV, first full paragraph. It says, we shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly those who have commenced work with other alcoholics. And this is early on. After they published the first edition, they're like, we want to hear from you guys that are doing something with this book. But who we really want to hear from is people that are actually working with others, showing people what's in the book and how to put it into practical application. And so then on page XVI, second full paragraph, last sentence, Bill finally realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be Dr. Bob. You skip down to the very end of the next paragraph. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic can affect another as no non-alcoholic can. Same applies for the addict. It also indicates our strenuous work. One addict with another, one alcoholic with another is vital for permanent recovery. So we're not even out of the first. So that's three times they've mentioned this idea of working with others. And then we go to the foreword to the third edition. Last paragraph. In spite of the great increase in the size and the span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic or one addict talks with another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. So there's four times they've alluded to carrying the message. And then we go to the doctor's opinion.
Forward to the fourth.
Oh, at the end of the fourth edition, which I'm not a big fan of, in any meeting, anywhere, AA share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics or addicts. There we go. And then you've got doctor's opinion, XXV in the letter.
So we're XXV. We're two behind you. Are you on a fourth edition?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So XXV, fourth edition. In the course of his third treatment, Bill acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis, the foundation of the rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 appear to have recovered. So that's number 6, I believe, and we're not even to page 1 yet. XXVII. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death and insanity. And on the previous page, there's another statement. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, well, the altruistic plane is when we do something for other people and we don't expect anything in return. So that's 8 times, I believe, now that they have referenced or alluded to this idea that we help other people by showing them how to recover. And we do that by sharing with them the practices that we put into practical application at once is one of the ways Bill, and it's written in the doctor's opinion. So if you're sitting here this morning, I hope and pray that there is this idea inside of you that has taken hold, that excites you about the possibility of sitting across the table and taking someone through the steps. Because if you don't,
finish your sentence.
It's going to be a long, arduous road for you. That's the jewel. That's the jewel of the entire program. I talked about it a little bit last night about the heart and the blood. The heart in this program is the those of us that are out here doing 12-step work.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brandon. So you're walking through an arid place, and all you need is a drink of water. And you come across this well, and at the well there's a bucket of water with a rope attached to it. And there's a sign that says, use the bucket to prime the well. So you're faced with this decision. You can either take the bucket, you dump it in the well, it can prime the well, which will allow more water to come into the well area to where you can actually get another bucket. Or you can drink the bucket of water and the well will go dry. This is your choice. So there's a certain amount of faith by dumping the water into the well that you're going to get it to return. Because if I dump it in there, then I might have no water. So I might want to hold on to this bucket of water and use it for myself. But if I do dump it in the well, and what works, what they say will work, will actually work, when I pull that bucket of water out of the well, I can have my bucket and I can get another one. And I can give another bucket to somebody else. But if I take the bucket myself and drink all of it, there will be no more of this well for anyone ever again. And that's what we're faced with here, is that if somebody wasn't willing to prime that pump, prime that well for any of us when we got here, we might be able to have this little spiritual experience that we're in the middle of right now, and then it's done. But if we return that spiritual experience to the well of all of us, I can continue to have that experience over and over and over and over again, as well as anybody else that comes in contact with that well. So, there are thieves within our fellowships. They come in, they get the experience. Somebody freely gives their time to take them through this experience. They take that and they hoard it to themselves and they never pay it back. And they continually get sicker and sicker and sicker. But then there's the people that come in, they get the experience, and then they share it with other people. And their experience is profoundly lifted up by every person below them that then comes in and shares in the experience and raises them to a level that is so far above anything they could ever imagine. That is our experience. The way that we go through the book, the message that we carry was given to Tarek Sponsor by a guy out of Texas. And then he was kind of the lone wolf in the Atlanta area. There was nobody else that was doing the work the way that he did the work. But then he picked up one guy. Then he picked up two guys. Then those guys started picking up some guys. And now we've got a... I guess if we actually had the lineage gatherings, we could probably have 100 people there from one guy. And when did he go through the steps with Mark?
2007.
Yeah, so less than 10 years ago. And all of a sudden, we've got this group of people that have created this pyramid that are raising us all up. And now the guys that I'm sponsoring are sponsoring guys, and those guys are starting to sponsor guys. And it's just the fellowship that you crave will grow up around you. You can't find anybody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous that you can relate to. God will bring them to you if you're willing to sponsor. Then you'll get this network of guys that just... You get to have this experience with them that is just like, these are the closest friends I've ever had in my entire life. And I've got buddies back from drinking days that would probably get rid of a body for me if I needed them to. And those guys aren't anywhere close to the friends that I have today. And so that's what we're doing here.
There've been three men, literally, that carried their message to me. I've been heavily influenced by other men and their messages. I've had many mentors through the program that I've learned stuff from and put into practical application. But three men in specific actually sat down one-on-one with me and transmitted to me what they had. And I don't owe any of them anything. But who I do owe is the new person walking through the door. Not today. 50 years from now. I want to make sure that the message that was carried to me is available to my daughter if her path leads her here. That's my responsibility. The preparation to carrying the message is the first 11 steps. You guys are getting a little taste of that while you're at the Bridges. You're getting acquainted with all the steps. And then the real work begins when you begin to go into the rooms of AA and CA and whatever 12-step fellowship you end up in that hopefully uses the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and your job is to take people through the steps. That's our spiritual job. It's more important than my wife and my daughter. And they know that. Now, something that came into my inventory this year was, can I make sure that my wife and daughter believe they're just as important? Not more important, but just as important. Because up to this day, this piece of work that I'm in right now, they always were second place, and they knew it. And I was okay with it, and they were okay with it. Now I'm starting to shift a little bit, and that's just by going through the steps this past time. So my goal now is to make my wife and daughter feel like they're just as important as the work I do in AA. And what I mean by the work is sitting down one-on-one. Now, I'm in this industry. I run a program. It is not my 12-step work. I meet with three men actively, one-on-one, and I work steps with them. I see a lot of people get into this line of work, and it becomes their 12-step work. And to me, that's not acceptable for me. I can't speak to what other people do, but it's just not something that I'm willing to do. There's a magic that happens one-on-one that I cannot explain. And I can't do it justice to try to explain it to you. My only hope is that you find out for yourself what that is like. And so this chapter, Working with Others, discusses two visits to a newcomer. I'm not going to sit here and read a lot of it to you. What I am going to tell you that they give you a series of questions to ask so you don't waste your time, that you can find out if the person is done for good and all, that you try to find out everything you can about them, that you never force them or try to convert them, that you help them look into their experience and you encourage them to speak about themselves in an honest manner. And you explain to them the hopeless feature of alcoholism and addiction by citing examples out of your own story. And then you do perhaps what Brandon and I have done this weekend, which is on page 94. So one thing, let me share this piece of information with you. Let's say you're at a meeting and a guy walks up to you and says, "Will you sponsor me?" Let's use me. If a guy walks up to me at a meeting and says, "Will you be my sponsor?" I don't give him a yes, no answer right away. The first thing I want to do is I want to set up coffee or lunch. I want to go meet him somewhere one-on-one. And I do this right here on page 94. I sit down. I share a little bit about my story. I convince him by identifying with him that I also have this loss of control, both physically and mentally. And then I outline the program of action. I explain how I made a self-appraisal. I talk a little bit about God, how I straightened out my past, and why I am now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that my attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in my own recovery. Actually, it may be helping me more than it is helping him. I make it plain to him that he is under no obligation to me, that my only hope is that he tries to help other addicts and alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. I suggest to him how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. I make it clear that he is under no pressure, that he doesn't have to see me again, that I will not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped me more than I have helped him. And then I tell him what it's going to look like. I describe to him what sponsorship will look like with me. We meet once a week. I expect you to do these things. You got to listen to these recovery speakers. You've got to go to these meetings. I won't work with people, especially new guys, if they don't go to two specific meetings so I can lay my eyes on them twice a week. And we start moving through the process. But what I tell them is, okay, so today is Sunday, it's 9:00. Why don't you take a few days and think about it? I want you to consider it and see if this is something you want to do. And then in 48 hours, so Tuesday morning at 9:00, call me and tell me if you're ready to go through with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous we call the 12 Steps. Just as many people call as don't call. So I just saved myself a lot of wasted time if the guy never calls. So that's one method. And where I get that from, I used to also do this. I used to, let's say I meet a guy, we have the talk, he says he wants to work together, he's in a treatment center, he's got plenty of free time. I used to say, go read the big book for me. You've got 5 days to read it. I want you to come back and tell me a little bit about it so I'm convinced that you read it. That's from page 96. Suppose now you're making your second visit to a man. He's read this volume, and he says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. So I got it out of the book. It's not something that I just made up, and it's not some punitive exercise. I no longer use it. It's been a few years since I've used it. But that'll also help you weed out people that are not serious. I think that's everything. I'm going to let Brandon talk about the 12th step for a minute. Go ahead.
So, the first guy that took me through the steps, we cracked the book, and he said, you need to take notes. He says, this is a textbook. And he says, we're going to go through some stuff that's not going to make any sense to you while we're going through it, but you need to take notes in your book, underline things, because you're going to use the same book to sponsor other people. I'm brand new. I'm thinking to myself, why would anybody want me to sponsor them? I've got nothing to offer. But I listened to what he said. As we went through the book, I took notes. And sure enough, I'm probably around the second or third step, and a guy comes and asks me to sponsor him. And there was probably no hope for this guy. He was an older gentleman that had melted most of his brain, and had some other stuff going on. But so I did what I thought was sponsoring, which was to go and pick him up in Atlanta and drive him to meetings out in Roswell. And he didn't stay sober, but you know, I got something out of that experience. And then all of a sudden another guy asked me, and I was a little further on in the steps, and I started taking him through them, and then he started staying sober. And but I'll tell you guys that I was 6 months sober, and I was sponsoring people because that's what I was told I was supposed to do. But I really didn't, my heart wasn't in it. I really didn't understand the purpose of it. I really wasn't having a transforming experience out of it. And if I were like most people, I probably would have just said, "Nah, screw this. Sponsorship takes up too much time. I'm not going to do it." But then God blessed me with this certain weekend where it was a SEC championship weekend. Georgia was playing LSU. And I like watching football, and there was a weekend retreat that I wanted to go to, so I thought maybe that's why I hadn't committed to going to any of these parties that were going to show the championship game. But there was something else in me that just said, no, just hang out. So I got a text message Saturday morning from somebody in the fellowship that said that they've got a guy that's staying in the La Quinta up in Roswell, and he needs a place to stay for the weekend because he's out of money and they're kicking him out, and they can't get him into a halfway house until Monday. And it just so happens that I don't have my kids and I have no other responsibilities for the weekend, so I volunteer to go help this guy. And send a text message to all these people because I have no idea what I'm doing on a 12-step call. No idea what I'm doing. And I get some messages from other people. I read part of Working with Others and try to understand that. And so I go and I pick this guy up. And he gets in my car. And so I do what I've been told to do, which is to just start telling him my story. And it's a rough story at this point. It's I talk about the bankruptcy and the loss of the houses and the kids out of my life and the wife that kicked me out and the 7 jobs in 8 years and all this stuff. All this crap that just like, this is of no use to anybody. This is just a bunch of shit that happened in my life that I'm really, really depressed about. That I really, really hate. It has happened to me, and I wish that I didn't have to go through it. And as I'm talking, this guy's sitting in the passenger seat, and his head just keeps dipping further and further down. And I said, well, now you tell me your story. And he said, I don't have to. You just told it to me. And in that moment, my life changed forever. Because I realized, holy shit, all that stuff I went through, all that terrible, terrible stuff that I am so ashamed of, is actually useful to somebody else. Because then we start talking, and this guy, he's been hanging around AA for years, but he's never done the steps. He's never gone through the book. He's just gone to meetings. At one point, he had something like 20 years of dry time, but he wasn't going to meetings, and then he started popping pills, and then he went back out, and then just the run started. But I mean, his story matched my story. And God put that guy in my life so that I would realize that I was actually a useful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody in here has that same weird shit that you are so ashamed of that you don't think that's going to be of any use to anybody. And the coolest thing about sponsorship is you will get a guy and you will... I'll say it with the guys I sponsor. I'll say it with Tarek. I'm like, I have no idea why this guy's come into my life, but I'm excited to find out. And we get somewhere into the fourth or the fifth step, and it's just like, holy shit, that's why he's here. Because he's shining a light on something I need, or I have a specific experience with something that I can share with him. And so everybody in here, we need you. There might be one person that you can touch that will die if you don't. You don't believe it, but I'm telling you, it's going to happen. And then it's going to happen multiple times. Like, one of the things that has happened for me is I did some shit to the woman that I was married to, the mother of my children, that she doesn't know about, right? And I can't tell her about it, because if I did, it would actually harm her. So I've got this place in my heart that I have to carry that crap around with and deal with it on a regular basis, right? Knowing that I can't fully make it right with her. And I wasn't done loving that woman. You won't hear me say many negative things about her. I may dislike the way that she approaches me on certain things, but I don't talk negatively about her. She is the mother of my children. And that's what I refer to her as. I do not refer to her as my ex-wife, because to me, ex-wife carries all sorts of negative connotations that to me, people bitch about their exes all the time. That's not who she is to me. She is the mother of my children. And I can't fix that relationship entirely, because I made a commitment to this woman that I'm going to stay with her for the rest of my life, and I did not. It has nothing to do with her. It has to do with what I did. And so what happens? God continually puts guys in my life that have wrecked home lives, that they're either getting ready to get kicked out, they just got kicked out, or they have no idea that she's getting ready to leave them. And I can see it, because I can feel it. I can know what they're going through. I can be like, dude, you got to clean your shit up. She's going to kick your ass out. No. She loves me. She has nowhere to go. Remember that guy that slit his throat and bled out for 15 hours? I pleaded with him for months of, dude, you got to do this work. She's going to leave you. She'll never leave me. Restraining order. She's gone. But God puts these people into your life to help those areas of you that need that healing. And if you don't sponsor, you're never going to get that stuff. You're never going to get those experiences where that part of you that you hate, that part of you that's rotting, won't get fixed. So it's the craziest thing. By me helping those guys with those wrecked homes, it helps me. It fixes me. And then the transformation I've seen in so many people is incredible. But one of the coolest things that two of the coolest things that have happened to me, and I'll turn it back over to you, is that. The first guy that I asked to be my sponsor was not equipped to take me through the steps as contained within this book. He tried. We sat down, but we were fumbling through the steps. And this guy's got like 30 some odd years, but he just doesn't have a way to deliver this message in a way that would a guy like me would understand. So. He had the humility to send me somewhere that allowed me to get a different sponsor. But so this guy, you know, we're all so judgmental that we watch the piss out of each other, and we're waiting, like, what's he doing? How's he doing it? Like, what's going on? And what happens is after a couple of years of me being sober and actually doing this as a way of life, this guy that is well my senior, has so many more years than me, comes to me and says, will you take me through the steps? And I do, and he has a life-transforming experience. You know, this is a guy at the time that had 34 years of sobriety that was humble enough to say, I know there's got to be more. And there's something that this kid's got that I want some of that. And so, you know, this guy's still a really good friend of mine. We go to lunch as often as we can, and to see him soften over the years as a result of doing these steps has been amazing. Well, the guy that I got passed off to, the guy that took me through the steps the first time, he decided that he wasn't an alcoholic anymore. And so he went back out. And so I tried to stay in touch with him for a little while, but it was pretty clear that he really just wanted me to leave him alone, so I left him alone. My 4-year sobriety day, I sent him a text message that said, I thank God that you came into my life, because the mechanism in which you delivered me to God was exactly what I needed to hear, and I thank you for being a part of it, because today I celebrate 4 years. And his only reply was, I'm coming back. Took him a week. And a week later, he calls me on Taco Tuesday. I'm cooking the taco meat, and he asked me if I would be his sponsor. And I mean, I'm weepy bawling in this taco meat, and like my family's like walking through the kitchen like, what's wrong with the taco meat that's making you so, you know, teary-eyed? Because in that moment, the power of God was so present to me. Is in that moment, I was just dumbfounded with the fact, like, how does that happen? How does the guy that delivered a message to me that was the right combination of words that got me to understand this is now asking me to help him? Like, what have I done that I stayed and he left? And it broke me down to this place where I was so thankful for the life that I have. And now this guy, he just celebrated a year of sobriety, and he was texting me at 4:30 this morning, explaining to me like some of the experiences that he was going through in meditation this morning. And I mean, he's passed so many other people that I've sponsored in terms of the elevation of his spirituality, because this guy's a seeker. And it came at a time where I needed another guy in my life that just wanted to seek. And so for me, you know, there's a lot of people that say, you know, you need to be a year before you sponsor, you need to do all these things. Well, Evie was 2 months sober when he brought the message to Bill. Bill was 6 months sober when he carried the message to Dr. Bob. The guy that took me through the steps the first time had 1 month less sobriety than I did, but he was 2 steps ahead of me. He didn't stay sober, I did. God picks sponsors. Somebody comes to you and asks you to be their sponsor, and you, everything in you is like, I don't know if I should do this. God picked that guy for you. You may succeed with him, you may not, but you're going to learn something about yourself. And that's, to me, this is the gravy, dudes. This is like where life becomes so cool, because you get to see this stuff on a daily basis.
Thanks, Pete. If you fit the description of the addict or alcoholic that's in the big book, I believe it's a requirement that you become useful. Otherwise, you will not achieve permanent recovery. Because part of our problem is we feel useless. And so when we begin to this part of the journey of being of service by working steps with other men, we finally have a sense of purpose. Now, there are a lot of people in the rooms and in the program that are necessary. They don't sponsor people. You got to find out which type of drinker you are. When Brandon read through those four types yesterday, if you're a type four, I'm a betting man, and I would bet that you probably got to sponsor people actively through the 12 steps. Maybe type one, type twos can be more of the service work inside the unity and the structure of the fellowship. And that's effective for them, and we need those people. I'm not saying we don't need them. It's just dangerous when they sponsor somebody like me and they haven't had the work steps. So this is why we've spent so much time this weekend asking questions, pointing you into your personal experience so you can discover your truth in the first step. You know, have I completely lost the power of choice? It's easy to see once I start that I've lost it. Well, have I lost it before it ever gets into my body? And do I believe I must work the 12 steps with another individual in order to stay in fit spiritual condition? So the old attitude in my life was, I am the center of the universe. Everything is affecting me, and I need to control its effect on me. My new attitude is, how can I be helpful? How can I attempt to practice respect and tolerance for your viewpoints and your opinions and constantly ask myself, how can I best meet your needs as opposed to my own? So my hero, Mr. Don Pritz, God, I wish I met that man in person. He used to say that the best definition for spirituality is enlightened self-interest. First time I heard him say that, I was like, huh, that's interesting. But then I heard his definition, the extended definition, which was, the best way for Brandon and I to get ours is to make sure everyone gets theirs first. I don't know if that's true. Could be a lie. If it is a lie, it's a lie that makes us better men. And so that's one of the core values in my life. Do I do it perfectly? No. But that is one of the core values in my life. And part of that is my communication with other people. And so one of the other things I try to do is I've tried to soften my delivery of the truth. So I try to tell the truth with some love. The deal is can I sink a sword into someone's heart and then pull it back out with them never knowing I even sunk the sword in? And if I can do that, if I can't do that, if I tell the truth and it's cruel, without love, it's very cruel. And if I come to you to confront you about something and I don't offer you a solution, that's brutal. And so two things I try to teach guys that I work with is, can we start telling the truth with some love? And can we bring a solution to the table if we're going to confront someone about a problem? These are just great rules to follow in life. These are all things I've developed in my attempt to carry this message. And the way I sponsor men is completely different. One guy typically is not sponsored the same way another guy is. I will, for whatever reason, over the past few years, brand new people do rarely ask me to sponsor them. The majority of people that come to me and ask me to sponsor them have been around for a while and they're struggling, or they have never really taken the look at the steps that we take. Every once in a while, I'll get a guy that's been around a few months or just in, but it doesn't happen as often as it used to, and I'm okay. That's my path right now. I sponsor enough men to where I can direct people and into different hands, and that they're going to get through the process. But what I do before I sit down with someone is I pray. And sponsorship is one of the areas where I completely trust what comes in prayer. And I'll get God will direct me. You're supposed to take this guy through the book line by line. This guy doesn't even need to open the book. You're just going to take him through the steps by having discussions with him about each step and giving him some exercises. This guy only needs to go into certain paragraphs in the book, and so you can do the exercises and get him through the process. The big book and the program is outlined is my baseline for all of it. I never deter from the big book. I don't do anything. I don't rarely will give an exercise that's not somehow in the book. And this is the modality by which I know my Creator. I keep my feet firmly planted on the ground by doing the 12-step work, which is one-on-one step work with other men. How do I keep my head up in the clouds? By reading these spiritual books and actually working with them, by having a spiritual teacher that's outside of the 12 steps, by being a part of a group of men that talk about spirituality, but it's something in my 11th step. The 10th and 11th step is how I keep my head up in the clouds, but my feet must be firmly planted on the ground.
Question?
Yes.
You know, sponsorship, if someone asks me to be a sponsor, my assumption is they have some clarity. Back in the day, based on where I've read, you know, most of the early folks who worked at Alcoholics Anonymous dealt with drunks coming to meetings. With that being said, you know, nowadays, when a drunk comes to a meeting and say a treatment center isn't an option, you know, just keep coming back and, you know, just don't drink, probably aren't going to work. So have you had that experience, and how do you deal with someone that comes into the room drunk, and how do you get them to keep coming back?
It's sad sometimes when you watch. In early recovery, I used to hang out at a clubhouse, and I remember sitting at the 5:45 meeting, and a guy that was drunk came into the meeting. And I've heard other speakers have this experience where people were disgusted that a drunk was actually drunk coming into an AA meeting. Looking back on it, I totally see it in a different light. I can't recall how I actually experienced it, but I remember the experience of the lady getting up and walking out because she was disgusted that he was in there drooling on himself in a meeting. But if a drunk can't go to an AA meeting, what the hell are we doing? That's where they're supposed to be. And but the other flip side of it that rarely happens, it's going to be at a clubhouse most of the time. Any of my other groups that are at churches, that are sort of one-off from the clubhouses, which are open to the masses, I haven't seen that. And the treatment centers and the detoxes and the hospitals, they're like a force field between us. Early days, there none of that existed. And so we were watching people die in the rooms. Now we don't get to watch them die. What do we? We hear that they're dead. We didn't actually watch the death process. Because the hospitals and the treatment centers shield us from that. It actually makes it a little bit... it's always somebody else that it's happening to. But when you get to watch somebody die right in front of you, that's a totally different experience. And there's a part of me that wishes that still happened. And it would ground people more into their first step if they actually got to see it.
It would allow people to actually believe that this is a life or death thing. Because there's people in here that when we say that, people are like, yeah, conceptually, yeah, okay, maybe I'll go out there and die. But they don't believe it because they don't see it. When you get connected with a group of people, you'll see the people dying. And then you realize this shit's for real. And you'll see people dying that once did the work and then stopped doing it. That's when it gets really whacked out. Or when it only takes a month. They go out and they're gone in a month. I mean, I sponsored a guy who was gone in a week. Sponsored another guy who was gone in 2 weeks. So, what do you do with the guy that's drunk? I can't take somebody through the steps that's actually drunk. The spiritual experience can't happen. If they get to a lucid interval, and I get some direction from spirit that says burn the guy through the steps and hope it works, then I could do that. But I've never had an experience where somebody was actively drinking that got anything out of the step work. So, if they're drunk, try to get them to a detox to where they can stop, and then tell them you'll start working with them. But if somebody's actively drinking, you can't touch them. That same guy that I told the story to, on Sunday I was telling him some of the same stories that I told him on Saturday because he didn't remember them. And he was stopped. He wasn't sober, but he was stopped on Saturday. So, I mean, in order for me to really reach their spirit, they can't be active. You can tell them some things, you can tell your story, but you're hardly going to reach them. Mm-hmm.
But one thing you want to do is make sure you reach them right when they're starting to be lucid.
Yeah.
Because then they're a little depressed, and they're more likely to accept what you have to offer. So you want to try to time it as best you can, because if they're coming in off a run and they're going to be very open-minded because their liar's voice is very low, so you can get through to them. But the longer you wait from the time they start getting lucid and all of a sudden the ego starts to rebuild itself, the liar comes back, and then before you know it, it's not that bad. You know what? I don't think she's going to leave. I'll figure it out.
But and a lot of what we're talking about comes right out of this chapter. Page 90, the third full paragraph says, "Sometimes it is wise to wait till he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it is better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he was drunk unless he is ugly to the family and needs your help. Wait for the end of a spree or at least a lucid interval. Then let his family or a friend ask him if he wants to quit for good." Wait, that didn't say one day at a time. "And if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered." On the other page, on 91, middle paragraph, last sentence says, "He may be more receptive if he is depressed." If you guys are depressed that you're here, good. Motivate yourself to get through the shit. If you don't want to die, motivate yourself. These are all good things. These are all self-preservation feelings that you get from inside of you. You're pissed off that you have to be there? Be here? Work the steps. Prove to everybody it won't work.
All right, I want to... I've watched over and over, I've watched in my time here, people take the working with others and they turn it into doing things for other people, giving them rides to meetings, loaning them some money if they need it, getting them some clothes.
Volunteering at church.
Yeah, all kinds of things that put this idea of carrying our message on a service plane, which is not what we're asked to do here. We're actually asked to precisely show others precisely what we did to recover. And so that now places their dependence on us, not God. That's the problem with that. And as a human, I will fail. I fall short. That's part of the human condition. So the guys I sponsor, I don't even like to use the word my sponsees, the men that have been brought into my life so I can show them this way of life, they know that when we're going to be working together, there's a bunch of questions that are going to be asked. If you have an issue or a problem, have you sat with it in meditation? Have you prayed about it? I want their dependence to be on God, not me. And so the one of the men that early on, this man Dante, who I'm still very close with, who really is responsible for me knowing the Big Book the way I do, because I sat in his Big Book workshops and I was a little sponge, and I wanted what this man had. And I remember I was always scared to call him to tell him I had an issue that I didn't know how to handle. And I finally did this one time, and he asked me. It was just like I had imagined it. Have you prayed about it? Well, no, I haven't prayed about it. I wanted to talk to you first. Well, you should pray about it. Click. That's how it went down. And I got the message loud and clear. I either learned to lie to him or I'd pray about it before I called him. And I hear my teachers have the same experience with the men that sponsored them. It's funny how that works. I keep ending up with guys that point you to God. So here's the deal. Two things you got is two sides of the coin. When you sponsor men, you're going to sponsor one of three. You're going to sponsor a bigot from time to time. And what I mean by bigot is the bigot is the guy that knows everything. There's nothing you can tell this guy where he's not going to say, I know, but I know something better. There's nothing I know that's not worth knowing. That's the bigot. Then you get the pious guy, right? The pious guy is the guy that knows all the religious texts way better than you'll ever want to know them. He can quote all the religious books, and he knows he's figured out God, and there's nothing you can tell him about God. They are the most difficult men to sponsor. And then you get the guys that have been completely burnt crispy. And they're shaken, and they're baking, and they're crushed by a self-imposed crisis, and they are completely open-minded, and they travel the path of consideration, and they do not resist you. They're not defiant. They just follow clear-cut directions. They're the funnest to work with. It is really enjoyable when you sit down with those cats and you do this work. On the flip side, you're a sponsee looking for a sponsor. Here are the types of sponsors you're going to run across. You're going to run across the sponsor that points you to him. You call me every day. You are my little pigeon now. You're my baby. You turn your will and your life over to me, and you follow all my instructions. Then you get the sponsor who's going to point you to you. He's going to say, you do 90 and 90. You stick with the winners. If your ass hints of falling off, you take it to a meeting. You always make sure that plug's in the jug. And then you get the sponsors that we've had. The sponsors that tell you, go to God. Go to God. Go to God. They bring you handfuls of water from the river. And then they tell you at some point, go to the river. Go to the river. So be mindful of who's coming to you with and what message they carry. And then be mindful of who asks you for help. So these are just things that you will learn these things with experience. I'm just trying to give you a little bit of the questions that you want to maybe have handy so you can ask them and figure out who you're dealing with.
Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. If I'm helping God's kids, I believe I get a sense of protection. If I've got two kids, and they're identical, and they both get little red wagons for Christmas, and one of the kids takes that red wagon, and he goes about the neighborhood, and he spreads joy and cheer, and he helps as many people as he can, and then there's the other kid that kicks the wagon to the side and says, I want a scooter. As a parent, who am I going to want to give more to? The one that actually takes the gifts he's been given and shares it with others? Or the one that takes the gift that I've given him and says, eh? Because that's what we're talking about here, guys. Is the more you help others, the more you give. I don't think that God plays favorites, but I think that God sits there and says, who can I help help others? And the ones that give that effort, that do those things, continually gets more. Because I can give this guy a bunch of shit, and he's going to make it about him. If I give this guy a bunch of stuff, He's going to say, look what God has done for me today. That's simple to me. It's that simple to me.
All right, guys, let's take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to wrap up.